And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're going to be having what I know will be an exciting and interesting conversation with, first of all, a faculty colleague of mine from the music department at Carthage, Dr. Edward Kawakami, who is the conductor of the Carthage Philharmonic. And he has just led the Carthage Philharmonic on a study tour of Europe. And so he is here on today's morning show along with three talented students who are members of the Carthage Philharmonic, all freshmen, Davison Krajcik, William Dowell, and Asnif Kaligian. And the reason Dr. Kawakami chose these particular students to be part of today's morning show in this conversation is because the three of them, along the way during this tour of Europe, produced a podcast in which the three of them would sit down together and discuss what had happened that day or over the course of the previous couple of days, highs and lows, and some of the amazing things that they got to see and hear and experience during this tour of Europe, which took them and their colleagues to Vienna, Salzburg, and Munich. And we also want to mention that the Carthage Philharmonic will be playing a homecoming concert this coming Sunday, February 10th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I really appreciate all four of these folks joining me today on the morning show to talk about this exciting trip and what it meant to all of them. So Dr. Edward Kawakami, Davison Krajcik, William Dowell, Asnif Kaligian, we welcome all of you to the morning show.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Great to have you here. So Dr. Kawakami, let's begin with you and this whole notion of what was what you like to call a study tour or rehearsal tour versus the more standard concert tour or performance tour that we hear so much about when groups typically go on trips like this. Explain to our listeners what this trip was supposed to be all about.
Sure. The impetus of it came from my own experiences studying in Salzburg, and how it changed my conception of Mozart and other classical composers. It brought it to life for me, experiencing the music in the culture, in the native environment that it was composed in, that it was conceived in, and to experience it in an environment where it's still alive and part of living history rather than some textbook history, as it's gotten a little bit in this country. And of course, it's an ocean away, so no doubt that happens. And I wanted that same experience for the students, because I know that after that trip, after those study sessions that I had there, it brought it to life for me. And rather than producing, that is playing concerts and sharing what we do, which I'm very proud of what we do, I wanted them to ingest some of these flavors that I'd gotten there and to have a working trip rather than it being a tourist trip where they just go to various cultural centers and points of interest. I wanted them to have a feeling of belonging. And I know that when I was in Salzburg, carrying around my briefcase of scores gave me a completely different feeling than being a tourist walking through town with a backpack and taking pictures. And to have that opportunity in Vienna, to be a working musician in Vienna, to be carrying their instruments along with the hundreds of others that they saw carrying their instruments on Vienna's public transit, I think they gave them a different feel.
Right.
And combining morning rehearsals with targeted explorations of cultural sites, of museums, of living houses, the Haydn-Wohnhaus or the Mozart-Wohnhaus, I hope, and judging by what I read in some of their journals and the feedback that I've gotten from them and from the podcast that these three produced, I think we accomplished those goals.
Right. So musically, you really wanted your students, in a sense, to be more recipients than givers, which is kind of the flip of what often happens. Like you said, typically a group goes over to Europe and then they get on the risers or they take out and perform, and you wanted them to be receiving something more than just warm applause from an audience.
Right. I wanted it to be a tour where they received and were educated just by the environment itself.
Right. Was this at all a tough sell for your students, just because I suspect none of them have been on a tour like this before? They've probably been on more of the standard performance concert kind of tour. Was it difficult to make them understand what this was going to be about and for them to kind of appreciate it going in?
I think that's best answered by these three, but I know that when I took the initial temperature of the room, everyone was really quite excited. It wasn't a hard sell at all. When I said Vienna, Salzburg, and Munich, it was kind of an easy sell.
Great. Let's ask our three students who are with us again, Davison, William, and Asnif. Did this seem like a strange idea to you? I don't mean the going to Europe part or these three marvelous musical capitals of the world, but more that it was going to be more of a working rehearsal tour than a concert tour. Did that make sense to you even right off the bat?
Yeah.
This is William.
The emphasis on the rehearsals, especially with pieces both that we've performed before, but also the magic two of our pieces, Magic Flute and the Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, were both very well in the early stages. So going directly to the source and getting the information as we're still developing both our style and our technical skills allowed us to really have a full understanding.
And even going in, you knew you were excited about that prospect, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think one of the things that interested us off the bat is that I think a lot of us have been on different school trips before, but I think what really pulled us into this trip was, like Dr. Kawakami said, we were really digging in not just into the tourist aspect of these places, but, you know, the real musical parts. And I think as music students and as members of the Philharmonic, I think we all have a base interest in that. So I think right off the bat, it was a very interesting thing to us.
Right.
And I think there was a common understanding that this was going to be a study tour because we went on this trip as part of our Carthage J term. So at Carthage, we have a January term where students have the opportunity to earn up to 4 credits in a class of their choosing. So this was, you know, we earned a college credit for this class, and so as such we knew, and the trip was presented in a way that we knew we would be, you know, we'd be earning that credit and you know, studying while we were there.
Right. In some ways a concert tour is more of a departure from what should happen in J-term. This actually folds beautifully into what J-term is supposed to be.
Right.
So I mean, not that you don't learn a lot from a concert tour, we should probably hasten to add, but I love the way this was put together and conceived. Was it hard to focus on these particular three cities? Were there particular reasons why it was Vienna, Salzburg, and Munich?
Vienna and Salzburg is kind of a no-brainer. It's the cradle of symphonic literature, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert. The first Viennese composition school as well as the second, Weber and Schoenberg and whatnot. Munich was a little bit of a little bonus at the end of it. Mm. I thought we're going westward, why not add Munich? And it has amazing historical interest as well. It has, I believe, 5 major symphonies in the city. Mm. And there was also a trip to Dachau, which I really, really wanted to include for the students' learning benefit.
Very good. We should mention that you had at least 2 other faculty colleagues along with you. Explain who was with you.
We had Dr. Greg Baer, who is the chair of the Modern Languages Department at Carthage, and also our German and Austrian expert. And we also had Dr. Temple Burling, who normally doesn't live in the arts, but that is his secondary area of scholarly interest, is material culture. So he was our museum and art history expert.
Very good. So what kind of prep was there before your departure, which was on Sunday, the 10th of February? What were you doing in those days leading up? Or nothing?
I wish that were the case. No, there was we opted to organize this tour entirely on our own rather than utilize a tour company, which had multiple benefits. Primary was that it saved the students probably 20 to 30% on the cost of the trip.
Wow.
And on top of that, it allowed us to really tailor the trip to what we wanted to do. And it's not something that companies that normally organize tours like this specialize in. We needed rehearsal spaces. Mm-hmm. We needed to have the flexibility to go and incorporate master classes. And also my colleague, I have a fantastic colleague in Vienna, Jörg Bierhans, who was the man on the street in Vienna and also our guest conductor there. He's also a conductor. He's got an orchestra too in Mexico, as well as freelances in Vienna and throughout Europe. But he's a wonderful guy, and he's got incredibly cultured and well-read, and he insisted that we go see the Third Man movie in Vienna, which is a movie set in post-World War II Vienna, starring our own Orson Welles. And, of course, Orson Welles was born and lived in Kenosha for a bit.
Right. Very good. So you had a lot – you especially had a lot of prep to make this tour happen before the departure and crossing every T, dotting every I. And then was the group rehearsing before you departed?
We did a little bit. As you know, we have the big – capstone program at the end of the semester, which is Christmas festival during the fall semester. And that's usually a nice delineating point. Up to that point, we had rehearsals to at least dust off the two pieces that we had performed before, and also to pull out the new pieces and have them read through it and get a little bit of familiarity with it and understand which portions that they would need to look over to have a little facility with it over the course of December. We also had two meetings before after Christmas festival, where Dr. Baer and Dr. Burling were able to chat with them about what to expect, cultural expectations, how to prepare, any primers that they needed for traveling overseas. There were several members of our group for whom it was their first trip out of the country, as well as their first plane trip.
Right. Davison, were you one of them, I think?
I was one of them, yeah. It was a really fun experience. You know, I think just doing everything for the first time really gave me a good experience to look back on.
Right. And I always think it makes sense for the first time to be with a group and with some people who know what they're doing, and there's a sense of reassurance in that, it seems.
I don't mean to be condescending at all, but Davison, I was two seats away from Davison on the plane trip. When it was taking off, it was the most exciting thing that I've seen. We forget how exciting airplane travel can be, and he was just glowing, and he was like glued to the window, and it was fantastic.
The great adventure, huh?
Yeah, I couldn't get that smile off my face.
Fantastic. Let's talk for a moment about the decision that the three of you made to create a podcast. And I have to say, by the way, as I listened to it last night, quite a lot of it, how envious I was that you will have this for the rest of your life, this document of what you experienced. And I wish so much that I had done something like that the previous two times I've been to Europe with musical groups. I would give anything to be able to turn back the clock and create this really thorough and thoughtful travelogue that the three of you created. So my hat is off to you. So whose idea was it? How did you come up with the idea? And from what I gleaned from our chat right before, this is not something that was thought of well before. It was kind of a spontaneous last-minute thought. How did it come about?
We were on our way to O'Hare, and in that time, Oz was sitting in front of us, and Davison and I were sitting together. And we were talking and trying to think of what we would do for our final project, which would either be a paper or some sort of creative or artistic project. We debated at first a vlog, but then we realized, one, we didn't want to be that group, and then two, it's a lot harder to keep it organized or really focus our thoughts.
Right, and we should mention that, so that would be like a video log.
Yeah.
So that would be kind of like what used to be just home movies of that people would take on a trip like this, and that kind of project did not interest you. Go on.
And then as we continued, we bounced the idea of a vlog between us two. Oz piped in from the front, and we basically at that time decided we may as well try. And then that's basically how it started.
Right. One of the things I think works for a podcast, which is then just, in a sense, just your words, is that's what we have, and that's all you have. And so you end up choosing your words well, and we're hanging on your words and really listening and imagining with you. And so I think it's a perfect vehicle to make this all work. So explain then how the podcast worked from that point on. On how many occasions did you put something together, and under what circumstances typically?
So there were days on the trip that we decided to get together, whether it was in a quiet space or just in the cafeteria of one of our hostels, and we would sort of formulate a outline for what we wanted to talk about. Usually these were days that it, you know, worked out good for us, and we just talked about what we were learning, what our highs and lows were at first, and this all kind of evolved throughout the process. So I think as we became more familiar with what we were talking about and the places we were in, I think we all just kind of gave our own inputs and had our own things to say.
Very good.
We really wanted to give it kind of a structure. You know, before we started recording, we sat down and we, you know, we said, okay, Will's going to introduce today. Asniv is going to give the, you know, we throw in a kind of pretend little sponsor, you know, just different, you know, different highlights.
Yeah. We're brought to you by caffeine.
This episode is brought to us by caffeine or cold showers because one day the hostels, there was no warm water.
Right.
So we, you know, we tried to incorporate different things and really give it a structure because this would allow us first to create, you know, a more, well, you know, it created a more high quality final product for both our listeners and for, you know, our teachers who we would have to submit this to for our credit. So yeah, it was definitely very planned out. It's called the one of our big kind of internal struggles in creating the podcast was finding a name for it, since it was so off the, you know, we literally conceived the idea on the bus ride to O'Hare. So we didn't have a name, you know, we didn't have a strong idea of what we would, you know, would be saying and everything. But
that became like a running gag then.
So yeah. Yeah.
And welcome to our unnamed, yet unnamed podcast or whatever.
Yes.
And then finally there's the big reveal at the very end where you do come up with a name, because we should say you want to keep doing this. Kind of hosting a podcast where you talk about your own, I guess, musical experiences at Carthage and so on. Which I think is great. Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking on the morning show with three members of the Carthage Philharmonic, Davison Krajcek, William Dowell, and Asniv Kaligian. And we have their conductor, director with us as well, Dr. Edward Kawakami. The Carthage Philharmonic is just back from a study tour of Europe, which took them to Vienna, Salzburg, and Munich. And we're going to be talking now about some of the high points of this really exciting trip. And we will also talk about their homecoming concert, which is coming up this Sunday, the 10th of February, at 1 p.m. at Carthage's Siebert Chapel. You made mention early on in your podcast, so I think this occurred right after you got to Europe, about some kind of a scavenger hunt. could we hear, and I assume, Dr. Kawakami, this was your idea?
I wish I could claim credit for this. This is Dr. Baer and Dr. Berling's brainchild. It was a cultural scavenger hunt where you had to take pictures, right, of in front of cultural monuments in Vienna. And the point was to get them acclimated to using public transit and also get them used to venturing out on their own without the faculty members with them.
Mm. So what was that like to explore Vienna in that respect? Sounds like it was kind of cool.
So this was the first thing, well, basically the first thing we did coming off of our, how long was our total commute?
I'm not quite sure. We left on the 7th, the afternoon of the 7th, arrived in London the morning, like 9 a.m., 7 a.m. of the 8th, and then to Vienna around noon, we got to our hostel around 2:30. Mm-hmm. So there, yeah, it's probably over 24 hours of travel total.
We had been awake for far too long.
Ergo, the brought to you by caffeine.
Yes, yes.
No, we were brought to you by jet lag.
We were brought to you by jet lag. Again, we had been awake for far too long, probably too long to be exploring a whole new city and public transit system. But it actually worked out that that was the first thing we did because, A, it helped us stay awake, and B, that was really important that we got to know the public transport system and the layout of the city before we actually had to be somewhere on a schedule, which was the next morning for our first rehearsal.
Yeah, and I'm glad we started in Vienna because Vienna just has such this mass amount of infrastructure and the different options you have for public transit. There were trams, buses, subways, and I'm glad we kind of got thrown into it all at once because it really prepared us for the rest of the places we were going. Salzburg and Munich, while they didn't have as many options, they were very similar in the sense that you could look at the map and know where you need to go, how you need to get there, and it was a good learning experience, and we got to take pictures along the way. We were still having fun, so I think it was a very good experience.
Yeah, it sounds like it was an effective introduction to that amazing city. Vienna is so cool. I really appreciated the description that you gave of the experience of rehearsing under the direction of this special guest, Jörg Bierhans, who was a friend of your own conductor. Tell our listeners a little bit about why this was such a rich experience for you, this experience of working with this conductor in Vienna, and what was so powerful about it.
The biggest thing is that when we rehearse normally, we are coming from an American mindset, which can be useful for some pieces, but we start to lose the stylistic and artistic interpretations. A big push through the first few rehearsals were to basically emphasize the classical nature and to try to fix and remove the romanticization of these pieces. As throughout the first few times and over time, these classical pieces become further romanticized as each symphony and performer adds something new. The goal is to try to take it back to the roots and play the music itself.
So strip away some of those romantic excesses that have come in. In fact, I remember you or somebody essentially quoted Maestro Bierhans as saying that even the scores themselves have been altered. It's not just that somebody takes the same score and plays it differently, but that even the scores that people are reading have been, in a sense, altered, almost vandalized, in a sense, over the years. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so the particular, well, should I throw that company? Am I able to name that company? Okay, so the particular music company which we had gotten our music from, which in the United States, so much of the music that I've played comes from this company. But basically, when different companies produce or edit and put out, distribute different pieces of music. And so with that, they go through different editing process and things get added or taken away pretty much, I'm not sure what the legalities of it are, but according to Jörg, this company was able to add quite a few things that really were not in the original. So
in other words, they were trying to avoid, for instance, copyright obligations. Mm-hmm. They could make this their version of whatever, and then they're free to publish it.
Yeah.
But they've taken an original piece and altered it without the composer obviously having anything to say about that.
Right. And now we're playing that that remix of that piece in Vienna with someone who is part of a culture that knows, the true, we're in the true place of the, where that originated. So so he was able to point that out, and we were able to kind of overcome some of those things.
So in a sense, you're trying to play this music from the classical era more classically, in a sense, more purely, without any of the modern sensibilities that sometimes creep in. One of you told the story about this guest conductor not having English as his first language, and at one point kind of struggling to find the words, and actually at that moment choosing to sing. And I don't remember who it was talking about that, but that, in a sense, that underscored the universality of music.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah, I think when we were talking about this, it was just a lot of the time as music students, we hear people say music is a universal language. So it was cool to see one of our guest conductors use music as sort of a communication tool where language fails. So I think it was really cool to see them put this into practice. Mm.
I know also in Vienna, you actually witnessed a masterclass that I think you were in the audience. It was the four seniors who comprise currently the President String Quartet who were kind of under the microscope for this masterclass. Tell our listeners what that was like to experience that, even in a sense as audience members.
As musicians, it was really nice because we're able to look up to these senior performers who, while they are the ones being coached and listened to, we as musicians are able to understand what they're playing and the feedback that they're getting. So although we're not the ones that are playing, we're able to see them and listen to what these guest conductors are giving them feedback on, and we're able to sort of catalog that in our memory, and it'll end up influencing how we play music and how we understand music.
Right. The biggest takeaways from those masterclasses was an emphasis on phrasing and an emphasis on understanding your role as an ensemble. Mm-hmm. When we play and we're learning, a lot of the time we play the music, we play it relatively straight through, and we don't really understand or add the artistic shapes that can turn a music from that sounds decent to something that moves you. And as an ensemble, it's important to have a sense of self-awareness and understand what each person's role is. Mm. And that was the major takeaway, was learn how to shape and then learn your place.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I took the most out of was most of our conductors had said that there's always a first voice, and that when the first voice comes out, you need to listen to them and accompany them. Mm. So when we put this into practice, it was really amazing to hear how much it changes the piece. And I think that when we're able to, you know, put this first voice into practice, it really can change how you're playing a piece.
Absolutely.
It makes me really happy to hear them say these things. It really does. And it tells me that the goals and the aims of the study tour have been met. And one of the things that I always get upset about is that we've put classical music in a museum case. Mm-hmm. And we've said, admire it, but don't touch it. Don't mess with it. It is sacred. It is priceless. But I think that the conception is a little bit different in Vienna and Salzburg. It is alive. It is still of a material that's malleable, that is meant to be touched, that is meant to be played with and stretched within the context of whatever era it was, of course, supposed to be performed in. But to have these students say that they basically took the case off and they put their hands all over this piece of art and played with it, it makes me really happy.
Right.
That's definitely one of the more core observations and realizations that we had as students, and, you know, us three and the whole group, is that in Vienna, in Salzburg, the music is, it's like Dr. K said, it's not in a box like it is here in the United States. I think oftentimes things in the United States are compartmentalized. So we have a box for the people who like music, a box for the people who are really into sports. And of course, there are different subcategories, and you can like both, but the idea that you can only, you know, you have to be a certain person to enjoy certain things didn't apply in regards to music there. And I think part of why this trip was so magical for us is that working with these guest conductors, seeing these museums, being in the city, sort of unboxed music.
One of my favorite memories is hopping in a cab in Vienna, and the taxi driver was blasting a Strauss waltz.
Gosh, it's so great. I mean, and here we would never get that.
Yeah,
I mean, if I play classical music in my car and I'm picking up a friend, you know, it's like, And it's because we have this idea that if you don't play, if you're not a musician, then you can't appreciate that, but that's so wrong. And I think anyone who could visit Vienna or Salzburg or Munich could see that.
Right. I think it was you, Asni, who also mentioned for the concert that you went to where you saw the
Vienna Symphonica.
The Vienna Symphonica, that you noticed even just the way the audience carried themselves and they were receiving this particular concert with a certain level of reverence. I think you joined in, William, as well, in observing just how hushed the hall was and how you could just tell the audience was so appreciative of being there, maybe in a way that we don't always have over here. I want you to talk about a special exhibit that you went to while in Vienna, which involved exiled art. And I could just tell by the way you talked about it that this was a very powerful experience for all of you. Explain to our listeners what the exiled art exhibit was about.
So the Exile Art Exhibit was a collection of artifacts and information regarding music, musicians, conductors, composers, all these different people who were involved with music around the time of World War II who had been pushed out of Europe and specifically Austria. And a lot of these conductors were... Some of them weren't as well known as others, but it was really not. It was not a life-changing experience, but it was a very moving experience to see all of these fellow musicians who had been sort of pushed out of their homes because of their art. And I think it was these exhibits were. Some of them had artifacts like journals. Some of them were. Just notes and letters, but seeing this exhibit was really, I think, for some of us, a very personal thing because we're all musicians and we're all seeing how even music can be censored.
Mm. And very much was, very much was. A few years ago, Decca, London Records, created a series that was actually, I don't remember what the German words are, but translate to be degenerate art. And it was all kinds of pieces by Korngold and other composers that had been very directly suppressed by the Nazi government. And so these were scores that so easily could have disappeared forever. And often by just dumb luck, these scores were preserved and brought before the public again decades after they were composed. So,
what's wonderful is that Vienna is now owning up to having exiled these artists for their art and also for being Jewish or gay or whatever minority they were part of that the Nazi regime was attempting to suppress and exterminate, to be frank. The director of the Institute said that after World War II, Vienna was not welcoming to these artists, mostly out of the fact that they didn't feel culpable. But now it's nice to see that they're owning up to it. There's an entire center in the university. It's funded, it's well researched and run by a very impassioned gentleman.
Good to hear. One thing that was interesting to me was to hear about the contrast that you drew between the Haydn House, which was in or outside of Vienna, and the Mozart House that you saw once you reached Salzburg. And it sounds like these were two really different experiences, or each very different from the other. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
The Haydn House and Mozart House are basically museums that showcase the lives of the individual composers and take place in the houses of said composers. The biggest difference between the Haydn House and the Mozart House is an emphasis on scale and commercialization. The Haydn House is much smaller and is almost a more cozy style. It showcases the history, but is much more laid back and almost kind of focused on the art. The Mozart House errs on the line of a tourist trap and is clearly commercialized and is advertised as this music museum, which, while it did give us more information, it didn't always allow us to fully appreciate the music and the history.
Interesting. I know that one thing that you said about Vienna, and maybe this was a way in which Salzburg was a little bit of a contrast, or no, I think you did see kind of the same thing, was the intriguing blend of very old and very new in terms of what you... Describe to our listeners what I'm talking about here.
So the very new and the very old, I think, were mixed together in both, like, the architecture that we saw, the infrastructure, but also just how people were, I guess. And I think one of the main things that I noticed right away was the architecture. So seeing all of the older churches and some of the newer modern buildings was just the first thing that popped out to me.
A good example of this is we took in a concert at the Mozarteum in Salzburg. It was a wonderful chamber music concert, and the concert hall was fairly new, I'd say within the last 5-10 years. Gorgeous, gorgeous space. The back wall was entirely glass. And in this, yeah.
So gorgeous.
It was absolutely wonderful. Concrete with wood, so it had this wonderful feel to it. But the glass wall looked out on Schloss Mirabell, something that's several centuries older. So that you can, out of this very modern concert hall, recital hall, you can see the very old. And there's an ownership of both. And that they're, somehow they don't clash. The aesthetic doesn't clash. They're very symbiotic.
Interesting. I understand there was a snowball fight in Salzburg.
That was not my fault.
What was this about?
Well, throughout the trip, so our guide and guest conductor, Jörg, was the one thing he kept saying was, why would you come in January? Because it is, as we came to know very quickly, it's very rainy, snowy, cold, or some combination, dreadful combination of all three. And of course, we're going on walking tours throughout, you know, throughout the cities. So, you know, it didn't take away from our trip at all. In fact, the snowball fights were some of the ways that we, you know, overcame that. So Jörg had thrown a couple snowballs preceding our snowball fight on the top, on the top of a hill in a fortress. But that, you know, that was where it, you know, really exploded. So we had just gone on a tour through a fortress, you know, a medieval fortress from Salzburg. And after that, we were waiting for everyone to come through, and this snowball fight just erupted, and everyone seeing our, you know, that was probably the point when we knew we were totally comfortable with each other as a group, when we had section leaders throwing snowballs at us, you know, which is normally...
Or at me.
Or our conductors, you know, of course we're adults, but we still see our professors as our adults. But that's, you know, that's kind of when we knew... Yep, we're comfy with each other, guys. Here's a snowball in the face.
Yeah, it was really fun. I think it was, to me, it was one of my favorite memories of the trip because we were kind of, we weren't set back, but we were able to kind of take a step back and have this fun experience in the middle of this really historic place. And just now thinking about it, I have a super big smile on my face because it was just so fun. And we took the shortest break just to have this really fun experience.
Well, and that's not when you think about going to a place like Salzburg, you don't think about snowball fights. You think about string quartets and everything else. So the third and final city is Munich, and on the way to Munich, I assume, is when you pay a visit to Dachau. I remember taking the Carthage Choir to Dachau in January of 2000, so I can well imagine what that experience was like, and you described it very eloquently on your podcast. What would you want our listeners to understand about what it was like to walk the grounds of Dachau?
Walking through Dachau was the biggest and most, influential parts of my trip, especially through Munich, because I think when we were going through here, we knew that we had to have this sort of reverence for the place because of the history that surrounds Dachau. And I feel like as Americans, we're taught what happened during World War II in school. And after that, we don't forget about it, but we don't really understand maybe the impact of what it had. So going through Dachau, for me personally, it was a very humbling experience, and it was a very, in the words of Dr. Kawakami, a very sobering experience. And I don't think I fully anticipated how humbling the experience would be. So being present in such a historical place that, such atrocities took place, it was very life-changing to me to be able to be present in this place. Mm-hmm.
We encourage the students to experience the place on their own, so singularly, without friends, without groups, to walk around and experience it on their own. And as I walked around and I had tears streaming down my face at a certain point, every single student I saw had red eyes. It was I've been to Hiroshima. I've been to Manzanar, where Japanese Americans were interned in California, and I've never been affected like this. The absolute, protracted, intentional cruelty that took place during World War II is just earth-shattering. It's
What I think is interesting extraordinary about visiting Dachau, in a sense, is how much isn't there. I mean, a lot of Dachau are kind of empty grounds, or buildings that are largely stripped of their original purpose, although not entirely. I mean, there are certainly very vivid remnants of the terrible things that occurred there. But you are also, in a sense, left to your imagination when you walk the grounds of Dachau. And I think a lot of people who visit it don't anticipate that's what it will be like. Had any of you ever experienced anything like that before?
Well, I'm Armenian. My parents are Armenian. That's my, I identify as an Armenian American. So if you don't know, the Armenian people also experienced a genocide in 1915 that went for a couple years and had previous roots of they were not accepted and where they were in the as part of the Ottoman Empire. But anyway, so this summer I had been to Armenia for a similar music trip, but I was able to see for the first time different sites and monuments devoted to recognizing the Armenian genocide. So it was interesting, where I have that sense of where I can kind of relate more and identify with the Armenian genocide memorials and things. Dachau is different because the Armenian genocide didn't take place in concentration camps. There were work camps and things, but to see a place with grounds and buildings dedicated to the, captivity, to the imprisonment of these people was definitely a distinction. And I think part of what you said with that kind of emptiness, that bleakness, even going there in January when there's snow on the ground, the trees are skeletons, I think kind of really amplified the feeling of being in a place, in a camp where this happens, and seeing what unfortunately so many people saw for the last time was just really moving. And I think part of the reason that these places exist and why it's important that they exist and that we visit them and listen to the exiled art and all of these things. This is part of our job in honoring and making sure that these crimes against humanity never happen again.
And just to go off of what Osniv was saying, I think that one of the biggest things that I took away from this overwhelming experience is a sense of appreciation to not just the government of Germany, but overall that this place has been preserved so well and that we're able to experience the history as Americans. We're able to come to this country and really see what happened. And that for that, I'm very appreciative.
Mm. And that's something that our culture struggles with immensely. We talk, maybe discuss the crimes we've committed and the genocides that we have both attempted and succeeded in, but we never truly preserve or have confronted them. Mm-hmm. It is something you see, look at Dachau. The hardest part for me was not the camp itself. It was seeing the residential area right next to it.
Mm.
It's the overwhelming silence that, and in the U.S., our crimes, we are still silent about.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point, that the way they, as you said, Dr. Kawakami, the way they own this and in a sense are willing to share it with the world is a very powerful statement in and of itself. Well, overall, it sounds like an amazing trip, and I don't remember, but one of you said you learned so much, but you also learned how much yet there is to learn. I mean, as you begin learning a lot, you begin to realize how much you don't know, so it's an exultant and humbling experience all at once, and it sounds like it was just rich in so many respects, and I have a feeling you could not be more pleased about the way all of this has turned out.
I'm so glad that it made me more hungry. It was an appetizer of what they could learn and what they ought to learn, what they want to learn, and I hope that it translates very clearly into the playing. We had the majority of the orchestra with us in Europe, which is a fantastic thing, and I believe that they'll have a sensitivity to considerations that they hadn't before.
Mm. Well, we get to hear the fruits of all of this, in a sense, with the homecoming concert that's coming up on Sunday, February 10th, 1 p.m. at Siebert Chapel. It'll include music of Mozart and Schubert and Webern, and a wonderful opportunity for us to once again enjoy the beautiful artistry of the Carthage Philharmonic. So I want to thank all of you for being part of the morning show today, Dr. Edward Kawakami, and the three students who joined us as well, Davison Krajcik, William Dowell, and Osniv Kaligian. It was so great to meet you in person, and congratulations on the great work you did with your podcast. I'm thrilled to hear that it's going on from here, and I'll look forward to hearing more from your podcast, which has now finally been titled?
It's called Causing Treble. T-R-E-B-L-E.
As in treble clef. So very clever. So very good. So we remind everybody again about the homecoming concert on Sunday afternoon. And thank you again for being part of the morning show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.